serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode this week remembering two special men who just reached the finish line in their time on this planet. It could have come 75 years earlier for both of them, but they both felt there was a reason it did not, and the last three quarters of a century proved it with the lives they led and the examples they set. When we left off, we were hearing Patch Curtis's memory of March 8, 1945. A Japanese position in Antipolo on the island of Luzon in the Philippines had withstood bombardment from mortars and bazookas, and Patch was told to take a squad close enough to neutralize the enemy with grenades.
We were up on the lee side of a hill where they couldn't get to us, so I went down the backside and around, and it was kind of an open swale down and a hill up on the backside over here, and I went around. I made sure all of them had four grenades and full belt of ammo and so on. Well, I started out with them down and went around and headed around here, and I said, let's pick up the pace. We don't want to be standing around too slow and make a good target. And so we started kind of moving a little faster, and we were firing as we were advancing. And one of my guys stumbled and went down, and as he went down, he almost hit me. He was pulling off shots as he fell down, and I turned and said, he almost hit me. Get up. And he was down on his hands and knees like this. I kicked him in the behind, and he greatly started to get up and so on. And by then, the first bullet hit me over on the left shoulder here, and I figured, well, we were stopped. We were in wide open space, and we're not moving anymore. We're dead meat. So I started to turn to say, let's get out of here. And that's when the bullet hit me in the chest here.
What did that feel like?
It knocked the breath out of me, and I went down on my back. It spun me around. I couldn't get my breath. A fleeting thought went through, well, I guess this is it. But for some reason, I got my breath a little bit. Somehow I got initial shock. I guess my heart stopped or something, too. I don't know. But anyway, a guy grabbed me by one leg and pulled me back around this point of this little hill and so on. I don't know how they got me back up on the top of the hill in the back. I was unconscious by then. I woke up. I remember the aid man was working on me, and they were giving me some morphine. And I remember when I'd breathe, it was going like that, and I tried to get my hand over here to close it up.
So you could tell that your lung was punctured?
Well, I didn't know. It just hurt, and I couldn't get my heart to get my breath. I was real short of breath, and I was coughing a little bit, and I was in and out after that. But when one incident, I woke up, and my fellow squad leader, a fellow by the name, my last name was Carmona, he had me in his lap, and the aid man had told him to keep my shoulder up so I wouldn't drown in my own blood. So he was kind of holding me up in his lap. And I thought, for Christ's sake, Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. He says, well, I'll get the aid man to give you some more morphine. And the aid man, Andy Anderson, he said, I can't give you any more. It'll stop your breathing. So I said to Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. So that was about 11 o'clock in the morning, as they later on they were able to kind of tell me. That went on all the rest of that day. They wanted to get a stretcher party up, but the Japanese had moved in on the trail behind, and they couldn't bring anybody here. No ammunition or anything. They couldn't get anything up to us. They were still in radio communication with the rear, but they couldn't make physical contact because the Japanese had intervened. And they decided that maybe after dark they could circumvent the Japanese. So sometime after dark, they got a stretcher party up there to get me in. And they had took six guys on the stretcher to get me down off of there. So I didn't get down to the 1st Medical Squadron station till somewhere around midnight. And I remember one instance on the stretcher on the way down. I was in and out all the time, but one instance, a problem that I got kind of aroused. I couldn't figure out how to get me down off this level, but somehow they did. They laid us out in the yard before they finally got me into the surgeon, and all I can remember, somebody woke me up enough to say that I was getting my first blood transfusion. They showed me the name on the bottle there, and they read it off to me. Gaius, G-A-Y-E-O-U-S. Gately, G-A-T-E-L-E-Y. Anyway, that was the first blood transfusion that I got.
And what all did they have to do surgically for you?
They didn't really do much except took out quite a few pieces. They reconstructed, later on they told me, what apparently had happened. I had a pair of binoculars on, and the bullet hit the binoculars first and disintegrated partially. So in the stuff that they took out of me was the pieces of binocular castings, piece of glass, leather from my wallet that was in my chest pocket here, piece of paper from stuff that was in the wallet, bullet fragments, and some of the bullet fragments they wrapped up. Here's the dog tags. That's all I got back with.
You were wearing these?
That's what I had on at the time.
You had this dog tag on at the time, and you've saved it with a leather strap.
And it's still blood-soaked, and that shoestring is still soaked with my blood.
Wow.
And they were finding all that stuff in me, so apparently the bullet fragment, there's one large piece about as big as my thumbnail still down underneath there, and with that adhesive tape that's wrapped around them there that you see, they had a piece of the bullet fragments that they had found in the outer layers of skin there. All those pieces of stuff that you see shattered through there,
yeah,
that's a good part of that is binocular.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't, the binocular hadn't been on there, it's very likely the bullet would have gone through much cleaner.
And not spread out so much debris in there.
Yeah.
And they had to take out a couple of your ribs?
Yeah, that happened a year and some months after. These two ribs that they took out wouldn't heal. They developed osteomyelitis, and they were getting worse and worse.
But basically the whole right side of your chest
is
crushed, destroyed, bruised.
Right.
Your lung was damaged.
Right. The first operation, they didn't think there was anything in the lung. It was collapsed. And when the lung collapses, apparently a hard coating forms on that, and they have to strip all that. They called it a decortication operation. They stripped that off before the lung can re-expand. Apparently they did that, but apparently there was still stuff in there because in January of 1946, I started coughing up blood. They couldn't figure out what that was, but they took a lot of pictures and stuff in there. Again, the Veteran Administration was completely overwhelmed. They couldn't find a bed to put me in. They wanted to send me up to some hospital way up in Oregon, and I didn't want to go up there because I didn't know anybody. I had the job down there that I thought I would, because I went back to work on January the 1st.
Well, wait a second, though. You went back to work, but I know that one of the other effects of that injury, at least in the immediate aftermath, was you really didn't have the use of your right arm, right?
Yeah, right.
What kind of state were you in for the next few weeks after you got hit?
Initial medical help.
Yeah.
I was transferred to the 41st Field Hospital in Quezon City. That was a place to get your feet back underneath you and get a little weight going back and so forth. And I was there for several weeks. They moved us down on the docks in Manila and put us on a hospital ship for a general hospital down in New Guinea, back at Hollandia. I was on this hospital ship on April the 10th, my birthday, on the 12th of April, and the day that President Roosevelt died, that came in over the radio, that President Roosevelt. And then I wound up down in this 54th General Hospital in Hollandia for quite a while. That's where my arm wasn't working.
And when you say it wasn't working, you had no control of it all or no strength?
It was cold. I couldn't lift it. I could feel some. I could move my fingers and so on, but I couldn't do anything with them.
Because there was muscle damage from the shot you
received. Right. They also said there was probably some nerve damage.
Sure.
Which disappeared. That problem disappeared later on.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, well, how long did it take them to recover? And that's probably not a simple question, because in some ways you probably never recovered.
Yeah, that's right.
You've had to live the last 70 years without full respiratory function?
Right. I'm short 50% of my normal air.
How has that affected your everyday life?
It was interesting as at work, you know, these eager beaver bosses, you know, when they make a factory tour, they go out at full stride, you know. If I was in one of these parties, you know, by the time we'd get about halfway through a department, I would go, everybody would go, what's the matter with this guy? One other interesting aspect to this mental, I was walking down the aisle one day by the acetylene welding department, and you know when you hang an acetylene torch up once in a while, it goes pop, 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 pop. I was walking by, this guy hung up his torch there, and it went pop, 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 and I found myself under this workbench over here.
You thought you were back in the jungle of the Philippines dodging bullets, huh?
Yeah, just like that.
And the other thing I've got to say, I don't want to be melodramatic, but we talked about your four kids and 13 grandkids and 30 great-grandkids and a great-great on the way. And after hearing your story, it sure seems like it's a miracle that any of them were ever born, because most people wouldn't have survived what you went through, and it sounds like it took a lot of help from a lot of other people to save your life.
That's absolutely true. I've had help all of my life, and that's another thing I marvel at. My grandmother picked me up after my mother died. My friends in San Francisco picked me up after I lost my place on the ranch. On and on and on and on.
And those guys had to drag you out of the spot where you got hit.
Yeah.
And they're risking their own lives in doing so.
Absolutely. All the way. And all the other people down the line that have ever had anything to do with. And you, now here, you're helping me spread the word, which is something I believe in. We need a lot of improvement in our patriotism in this country. We are in a wonderful country that we live in, and you only have to see the results of occupation like occurred in the Philippines that other countries do to you, and what it might have been like had they been successful in doing that to us, including the Japanese and the Germans.
And, you know, on the topic of your injuries, what do you attribute your survival to?
I really think I'm a lucky recipient of modern medicine. I'm sure that's what did it. Penicillin. I think I owe my life to penicillin.
That you didn't get infection, gangrene, losing limbs.
Because in discussing this with doctors and so on, and what little I've read, in the Civil War, if you incurred a wound like this, you were gone unquestionably. That was it in 10 days. And World War One, the best assessment any doctor has been able to tell me is that the calculated figures for a wound of this era was 2% in World War One. They didn't know what it would be in World War Two because they had penicillin and they had sulfa. Well, here I am, so what's the percentage? Who knows? But it's pretty good.
Well,
and I'm one of them.
Yeah, and you're still going. Well, I don't want to forget this. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. Have you ever had a moment where you resented what happened to you? Or you felt that it wasn't fair? Or you wished that it hadn't happened? Has it affected your life to that degree where you felt you didn't get a fair shake?
No, I don't think I ever looked at it that way. I do look at it like, I'm a victim of fate. I wish I hadn't had to go through some of that stuff, but that's the luck of the draw. Because I've survived and I'm here and I've seen a lot of neat things since, I'm pretty darn lucky.
I had a feeling that was your perspective.
Yeah.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I guess I never really tried to analyze that thought of what I would be most proud of, but right now, off the cuff, I'd say I'm glad I was able to do something for my country.
And I know I've mentioned these totals of your descendants a few times, and I only do so because it's an impressive number, but the reality is none of them lived through any of this. So it's not as real for them as it was for you. For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't see any of this, who didn't understand what could have been and what almost was, what do you think we need to know about you and all the guys like you who risked their lives for our country?
I would like to hope that we could all be aware of what it took, of what it was and what they did, and order their lives accordingly, and also somehow gather the feeling that they too could make a contribution like that if they were called on to do that.
And the last thing I have to ask you, and feel free to add anything else, but you've made it very clear how close you came to not coming home, to adding to that number of over 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. How often over the years have you thought about some of those guys you knew who didn't come home?
Almost every day. And it's kind of interesting with the computer. It's been able to give me a greater understanding of what happened to some of them. For example, this Carmona that I mentioned, he lies in the Roswell Cemetery. He was given a Silver Star for his action the next day after I was wounded in killing the Japanese that stopped me. The other one that I turned up, I mentioned earlier that I stepped aside to let my BAR man shoot this first Japanese. He received a Distinguished Service Cross for his actions on March the 9th, along with Carmona, in subduing the Japanese strong point.
And in my understanding that they were both killed that day?
They were both killed. They were both awarded their awards, a Silver Star and Distinguished Service Cross, posthumously.
And with Carmona, so people remember, you're saying he was killed the day after you were hit, but what you shared with us is that he was one of those who helped save your life by cradling you and holding you upright so you didn't drown in your own blood.
Absolutely, and a day later he was dead. So I forever have a debt to him. I think about some of this stuff every day.
For a long time.
Yeah, and probably will. It's kind of tough. I keep telling my oldest son, I said, I don't know why in God's world I spend so much time thinking about it. And I think Cynthia probably gets tired of hearing me about it. And any of the grandkids that spend any time with me probably, well, it's a part of me. So,
yeah, and they wouldn't be here if you didn't survive it.
Yeah.
Hard to argue with that one.
I make a long story out of it. It sounds like a whole lot of things and so on. But remember, I was only in combat 5 months. Other guys, many, many other guys, were in those same circumstances, under those same dirty physical conditions, the mental strains, the whole world, for weeks and weeks and months and years. So they contributed far more than I ever did.
That's what I need to ask you. Whatever happened to the Pearsons in that prison camp?
Oh, I forgot to bring that point out, and I'm glad you brought that up. And that Mrs. Pearson died, Willard's wife died, little Mike died. Mr. Pearson, Willard, and Virginia and her husband came home.
Well, and I know you're not looking for attention or glory or credit, but you told me your motivation for wanting to go over there was the fact that they were imprisoned there, and you were part of the effort that liberated the Philippines and led to their liberation from that camp. Does that give you some satisfaction?
Yeah, it does. Oh, absolutely.
None of us really knows completely what happens when we breathe our last on Earth, but I imagine that just as Ralph Teason enjoyed a heavenly reunion with Tom Begley, that Patch Curtis has not only connected with the once-imprisoned Pearsons, but also had a chance to thank those fellow 1st Cavalry Division veterans who saved his life before giving their last full measure of devotion the very next day, 75 years ago. So here's my question. Is your perspective on life and liberty, on the freedom so many have fought and died for, and maybe even on the need for unity in our nation, has that perspective changed at all over the last hour? If so, it's just one more reason to be grateful for men like Ralph Teason and Patch Curtis. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we hear from a World War II Navy veteran who survived some of the Pacific's biggest battles. There's no doubt we'll be reminded again, as we are whenever we take the time to listen to our veterans of any vintage, that freedom is not free.